listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have Alistair McLeod with us for this first show of 2022. Today I want to have him to talk to us about his December 23rd article, Gold and Silver Prospects for 2022. Also want to get his thoughts about 2021 and why gold was so disappointing. Although, as we heard from Michael Oliver a little earlier, he felt that gold wasn't all that disappointing if you take a longer-term look at things. So, and he expects that it's going to be very bullish for this year. I sense that Alistair may feel the same way. Alistair, thanks so much for joining us again.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
It's really good to, always good to hear from you, because I always so much enjoy your, every Thursday, your essays that come out, your articles that really get into the nitty-gritty and the things that most people don't see or don't look that deeply into what drives the markets. And today we want to, as I just said, we'd like to hear what your thoughts are on gold and silver prospects for 2022. You mentioned at the start of this last article, that is the article on December 23rd, that the key to whatever's going to happen this year will be the interest rate outlook. And I want to ask you about that and get into your forecasts or your ideas about 2022. But maybe first just ask you, how do you explain what seems to be a poor performance for the precious metals in a year in which we've had this enormous amount of money creation? We've had, inflation rates that are the highest since around the 70s. And this whole tremendous disconnect between the real negative interest rates. All of that should be very, very bullish for gold, and yet it hasn't really, it was actually down in the year. So how do you reconcile that?
I think there are two things to say. If you look at it in the context of history, I think what you were saying was that Michael Oliver before me was saying that, in the longer term, it's actually been a reasonable year. Yes. And I think I would echo that, because I would regard it as a period of consolidation. And I don't necessarily recommend people follow charts closely, but it's generally a rule that when you get an extensive consolidation period, the move out of it tends to be a lot stronger as a result. So I think to look at the performance and say, well, that's terribly disappointing, I think he's just sort of being rather selective in terms of the overall view. The second thing I would say is that markets are well and truly broken. I mean, you pointed out that we've got very high negative yields on U.S. treasuries. I think that as far as the markets were concerned, until very recently, people were thinking that, okay, inflation is a bit more sticky than we first thought. And it's, the Fed obviously made a bit of a mistake saying it was transient. But, once the logistics thing is sorted out, it'll all return to normal and we'll be back to sort of drifting back down towards 2% target and so on. Now, that is completely wrong. It is a Keynesian, a very distorted Keynesian view. And one of the things that's most frustrating for an economist such as me is watching the Keynesian narrative just dominate everything. It's patently wrong, and it's led to markets being broken, in effect. Now, the reason this is so important is I think in the coming months, maybe even the coming weeks, it will become more apparent to the investment community, the Keynesian investment community, that this idea of inflation actually is going to get worse. And the reason it's going to get worse is basically because of all the money creation that's happened over the last 2 years in particular, and since the great financial crisis as well. I mean, if you look at what's happened to M2 money supply, I mean, that's been growing at an enormous rate. I mean, we're looking at annualized rates for nearly 2 years of just under 50%.
Incredible.
That is absolutely incredible. Now, a lot of people have made tentative comparisons between the current situation and the inflationary times of the 1970s. Well, I looked back to see what sort of monetary growth we had in the 1970s. And at the very, very worst, in the middle of the 1970s, money supply grew by 13.4%.
Oh, jeez.
Now, so there is absolutely no way that we're going to see an easing of the rise in prices because of the enormous amount of stimulus which has been pushed in, not just by the American government, but by every other major government as well. And in the American case, of course, you've had these stimmy checks, which
yep.
put into everybody's bank accounts, and that's had a pretty immediate effect on the demand side, without really the production being there to meet it, because half the production has been shut down either because of COVID or because of logistical problems and all the rest of it. So prices have started rising. I think the last CPI figure I saw was 6.2 or 6.8%.
6.8, I believe. Yes.
But that's irrelevant. I mean, I really do think that in the coming months you're going to see this well over 10% because of these monetary factors which are driving the whole thing. And I think this is the thing that our Keynesian friends just do not understand. The other thing that's interesting about the 1970s is that when we went into the 1970s, everybody was Keynesian. I mean, they really were. And then as it sort of transpired that things were going wrong, suddenly you found that there were people like Milton Friedman on
right.
the television. You know, people were beginning to listen to the monetarists. So, and I suspect we're going to have the same thing happening here. When things don't perform as the Keynesians expect, then I think you'll find that people will turn to other sources of information and question the whole Keynesian narrative and think, well, perhaps there's something behind monetarism, after all. No, I'm not a monetarist because it is not as simple as that. And I think there's plenty of evidence to back that view. Nevertheless, I think, the one thing that Milton Friedman said, which is absolutely right, is that the origin of inflation is money. It's as simple as that. I mean, if you're going to double the quantity of money, you're going to halve its purchasing power in very broad terms. And that's really the situation we're in. So I think that, coming back to, last year, what we saw was broken markets, a period of consolidation. The bullion banks had a problem insofar as they had these new Basel III regulations, which in America were introduced in the middle of last year. In London, they were introduced from the beginning of this year, in other words, a day or two ago, because today is actually the first day. It's not a public holiday here. So
Today.
We're talking about the net stable funding ratio, which disadvantages banks dealing in derivatives. It disadvantages banks running open positions on their own book. And it disadvantages banks taking very large deposits. So you can see that there's a lot of change going on. And I think that the banks have tried to prepare prepare themselves for this to a degree. And that has involved suppressing the price of gold, silver, any other commodity where they're running a book as much as they possibly can in order to recover their short positions.
Okay.
We've seen this. We saw open interest on COMEX being hit every time it sort of poked up a little bit. They came in and they tried to get it back down again. And fortunately for the bullion banks, you've got I can only call them idiotic hedge funds who just think in terms of a pairs trade, and they don't actually understand that they're just setting themselves up to be ripped off by the bullion banks. But it happens every time.
They buy at the top, and the bullion banks make all the money on the downside. And
I mean, you're right. I mean, you know, from a bullion bank's point of view, once a hedge fund has bought it, his next transaction is going to be sell it. So what do you do? You encourage him to sell it at a profit to you. It's actually no more complex than that.
You know, Alistair, I don't know if it's true in the UK, but here we're seeing wages going up dramatically as well. And that feeds into the inflation picture as much, if not more, than it did in the 1970s when the labor market was very strong here. And it was after the U.S. sort of exported its higher paying jobs around the world. And then the labor unions were sort of crushed by that. And we've had these, you know, many decades of labor, you know, common labor folks just not keeping up at all with the cost of living. And now, of course, they're seeing these stimmy checks, as you point out, from Uncle Joe being sent out to everybody. And they can sit on their couch and not go to work, which means there's less supply in the market. So less supply, but plenty of demand. And away you go. And it seems to me politically, at least the left wing, the left side of our political spectrum here, very much likes that idea. And certainly there'll be a lot of voters that think they do, except that the cost of living is going up faster than their wages. So, if the politics runs towards a restrictive monetary policy, which seems like it might have started a little bit with, some of the administration's policies. But in the 70s, as you point out, Milton Friedman comes along, and we had Paul Volcker. And Paul Volcker then tamed the inflation problem, which was threatening to go, I think, get out of hand in the 70s. It was getting out of hand. It could have gotten much worse. But I don't think you see that kind of thing happening, even if we have some people that come along with some common sense about inflation being caused by money. Do you? Do you think another Paul Volcker anywhere to be seen?
No, not at all. I mean, even Volcker, sort of created quite a lot of disruption by jacking up. I think he jacked up the Fed funds rate to 19.1% in the middle of 1981. And that really sort of killed the whole savings and loans industry.
Yes, I remember it well.
But this time with the amount of debt in the system, I mean, both government debt and private sector debt, non-financial private sector debt, any increase in interest rates is going to be very, very painful for heavily indebted economies. And it's not just America. I mean, look at Japan is in a far worse position. In China, it's unbalanced because you've got a relatively low government borrowing. I think it's around about 50% of GDP. But the private sector is absolutely up to its eyeballs in debt. And we've already seen that beginning to fall over with Evergrande. So, the answer is that I think that they've got themselves into a huge, great hole. They cannot afford to see interest rates rise to the sort of levels which compensate people for the loss of purchasing power of holding fiat currencies. So what that basically means is that, the rise in interest rates, for a start, it is unstoppable. I mean, but what I can see is that the central banks will get together and they will be determined to stop it, but that won't work. It will merely delay matters. And I think that inevitably what then happens is that we start having bankruptcies. We start seeing investment flows reversing. I mean, when the yield on the 10-year starts going through 2% and looking like it's going to go through 2.5%, and people beginning to sort of question Keynesian orthodoxy and saying, well, you know, this isn't true anymore, this is a new world, you can see that the foreign ownership of U.S. equities, which the private sector owns over $9 trillion of now. There are also, I mean, if you take the total, it's around about $14 trillion because you've got sovereign wealth funds and all the rest of it owning U.S. equities as well. I mean, when they start selling, I mean, just watch out. This, why are they holding U.S. equities? I can tell you the only answer is to make a profit. They're not told by their regulators, you have got to have exposure in that market. No, the regulators will tell them they've got to have exposure in their own domestic market. Foreign markets are for extra profit. And the moment that goes, you're out. So this is, I think that the interest rate scene is desperately important.
Right.
And we were talking just before we came on air about the comparison with the 1970s. Yeah. I mean, if you look at M2 money supply, it has been increasing for around about 19, 20 months at an annualized rate of nearly 50%.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So it's, you know, the quantity of M2 money has almost doubled. The if you look back in the 70s, when we had this real inflation scare, which led to 19.1% Fed funds rate at the end of the decade, then the maximum rate of monetary growth during that period was 13.4%.
That's incredible.
And today we've had two loads of 40%+ on the trot. I mean, you know, this...
Alistair, we're just about out of time already. I can't believe it. But you mentioned in your article the financial markets will be unprepared for the consequences of massive currency and credit expansion that has taken place in interest rates. And I have to just say, with interest rates so low, the pension funds have gone out in the equity markets. Now what happens if the equity markets start melting down? You know, what kind of a panic is that going to put the Fed into?
I think put yourself into the shoes of a pension fund or an insurance company.
Yeah. Right.
I think they're going to want to pick up on nominal yields rather than, buying equities cheap. Buying equities cheap is not a thing you do in a bear market. But if you're a pension fund, you're investing in the long term and you are trying to pick up the compounding effect of a decent nominal yield. So I think that that's probably where they will put their money. It's a very, very tricky situation.
Very tricky indeed, and time is tricky. We're out of it already. I can't believe it. I guess it means, I mean, how can you be bearish on gold for 2022? It didn't perform all that well, 2021. It did the previous couple of years. So long term, it's done very well. But your outlook for gold and silver, you believe even more bullish on, right?
Yes, well, I think the thing about silver is that you can add in that it is a major beneficiary of this move away from fossil fuels. I mean, if you just look at the price of other similar things like uranium, like lithium, I mean, the prices have just shot up in 2021. This is going to be the year for silver on that basis. And of course, on top of that, you've got monetary demand building as the currencies find that their purchasing power declines.
All right. We're going to have to leave it go at that, unfortunately. Alistair, thank you so much for being with us. And we'll look to do it again sometime soon, I hope. All the best and Happy New Year to you. All right, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Doug Casey, Chen Lin, Quentin Henning will be with me. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.